You know what would be great for a guy like me? Just to be in a coma. Would that be great? Boy, you know, you just crap out, nothing to do all day. You breathe through a fucking tube, they feed you through a tube, and nothing to do. That's really living, you know what I mean? No phone calls coming in, nobody dropping by unexpectedly. And if they do drop by, you're completely unaware of it. Because you're in a fucking coma, and you're practically clinically dead. And you don't have to listen to their stupid bullshit. Their stupid bullshit. Like about their new ride-around lawnmower with the two-tone horn and the GPS in case they get lost on the lawn. And their boss and their job and their car.
Wide area in resistance calling. This is Terrible Tommy, Tom Metzger, right here in the bunker, right here in North Central Indiana. Yo, right out here where all the corn is getting ready to be picked. All that corn they put in everything you eat, it's killing you. And now they got the GMO corn and all that, which adds another reason to, they're killing you. And so, whoopee for corn. Whoopee for corn. It'll limit the world population, as it's doing with everything almost in the whole grocery store that's got corn in it. Ha ha! We're at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. That's where you send your donations for the show, and that's where you send donations for any other projects you'd like to help us with. And you send your snail mail there, and you name it. And then go up to resist.com and start getting an education, something that most of us haven't really gotten. And we've got it all up there on resist.com. We've got books you can read up there, get a real education. We've got tapes. We got all kinds of audio files you can listen to. You can listen to back radio shows. You can go back for years on our radio shows. Yeah, you can do that. Meanwhile, I'm here at Terrible Tommy's Terrible Tavern having a beer. Mabel's over there at the bar talking to some guy. I think he's a Fed or something. Got a suit on. Got a bulge in his coat. I don't know. And that's right next to Terrible Tommy's Terrible Filling Station, where we still sell Ethel, and we still sell Standard, regular. Yeah, we do. And then you can go out back to our big weapons of mass destruction used equipment yard. We're lucky we got in there to the Middle East and got a whole lot of that used U.S. equipment we shipped over there, and they just left it lay around in Iraq and Afghanistan. If we hadn't got a couple of shiploads of that shit out of there, there'd be somebody that might call themselves ISIS, pick it up and start shooting everybody, including us, including our troops that are over there. So the more I got out of there to sell to you people, the less we'd have a problem with that being used on us. But they're using it on us anyhow. The tanks, half-tracks, jeeps. What I get a kick out of is these guys, these Islamists from the Middle East fighting with Toyota pickup trucks. I love it when they put a big gun on the back of that pickup truck. Every time they fire, the front end of the truck goes up. Yeah. But you got to hand it to them with just an AK-47 and a Toyota pickup truck. They got one of the biggest army in the world, the most powerful army in the world, usually going the other way. How about that? I don't know. What do you think? Talking to a gal downtown today. I go in to get the mail and a couple of things. And she said her brother was over in Korea, and he'd done several tours, and now the VA is not going to cover a hospitalization and everything for his wife and family, not even housing. So they're shipping his whole family back to the States, and guess what? The only way he could get them health care was to re-up for another 2 or 3 years. It's amazing on television, all these filthy, rotten politicians, Republicans and Democrats, crying about our war heroes, our heroes, but behind the scenes, they're cutting their legs off. They're cutting them off at the knees. They're not helping them. They had more help 20 years ago than they do now. And, of course, we've got the suicide situation. More guys have committed suicide that were in Afghanistan than we lost to the enemy. Yeah. I've got something here. I may play a little bit for you. Guys come out with a new book on this sad situation. Everybody's a victim in this situation. The Afghans, the Iraqis, they're victims. The guys that go over there that are filled full of a bunch of bullshit by the recruiters and the television and all the guys that make the movies, how wonderful it is to go across the world someplace and shoot up a bunch of people, and of course you never get shot, and you got a gun that you can fire 500 rounds of ammo and never reload it and all that kind of stuff. It's all a big bunch of, as George Carlin, the Pope of my church, says, it's all a bunch of bullshit. And people swallow it because they want to, I guess. They get this stuff at the church. Oh, we're defending America. Defending America, my ass. You guys are doing more, you politicians are doing more to ruin this country than anybody else. My enemy's right here in this country. I don't have to go anyplace. I fight my enemy. The very worst of my enemies and your enemies are right here. They're in your country. They're in your state. They're in your town. They're all around you. We got an election going on here. The bullshit they're putting out is unbelievable. Absolutely. But yet the people get a lot of people get all excited about these elections. Huh. Well, that's that. Let me see if I can play a little bit about all these guys committing suicide on here. I did this recording as I was going down the road in the car, so if you hear anything like a cow a-mooing or something like that, well, you know I'm out on the road.
In anger, I couldn't sleep. If there was any loud noise, I woke up immediately. I would have very, very vivid dreams that once I had them would just keep me up all night. And I thought it was just something that would go away. I thought of myself as this tough guy journalist who had gone to cover war in body armor and wasn't sitting in Washington in a suit. And it didn't occur to me that this could be PTSD. And it should have. But finally, I hit what for me was a low point. An Army friend, who was later the best man at my wedding, said to me just bluntly, "You have PTSD. It wasn't, you might have. It wasn't, you should talk to someone to see if you have it. It was, you have it." And the issues that I faced about trying to decide whether to seek help, where to go find help, whether to tell friends, whether to tell friends and colleagues like you, these were exactly the issues Kevin Graham faced, exactly the issues Mark Graham tried to change. And right in the book, I understood their world because, unfortunately, I had lived it.
The issues you bring up in the book include the way, the different ways in which one son who was killed in combat was treated, or the family was.
By the time that Kevin took his own life, the numbers were beginning to rise, but they were not remotely at the epidemic levels that they have been these last few years. And it's worth noticing that more soldiers have killed themselves than died in Afghanistan, which is a really, when you think about it, a really shocking number. Even this year, with the wars ending, you've had more than 319 soldiers this year alone kill themselves. Last year, you had about 350. No one I've spoken to within the military thinks those numbers are going to start declining anytime soon. And when Kevin took his own life, the attitude then was these people in the military were cowards, they were weak, they were not worthy of wearing a uniform. One of the people I interviewed, General Peter Corelli, who later in his career would try to help fight stigma as best he could, was a commander in Iraq in 2004 who I knew very well. He lost 168 soldiers to combat. One of his soldiers killed himself. When he came back, the memorial wall for the unit had 168 names, not 169. And he told me in an interview that that was the single thing he regretted most of his entire career, that he pretended that this other soldier who had fought alongside his other men, seen the same kind of horrors, but took his own life, was treated differently and was not seen as a casualty of war.
Yogi, I think everyone listening to this program has had a sense of what PTSD is, but doesn't quite understand it. The extent of the suicidal feelings, the extent of the depression, the extent of the nightmares. Perhaps you can make that real for us.
Sure. It's worth also remembering that the names for PTSD have changed, but it was shell shock at one point during World War I.
Of course.
It existed during the Civil War, where after the Civil War, more than half of the patients in what were then mental wards were veterans of the Civil War. During World War II, this was something that shocked me when I found it, there were 500,000 troops during the war who were discharged for psychiatric wounds. So this is not new. What's new is that we have a name for it, and we have numbers. And the estimates for the veterans of these wars who will have some form of PTSD range from 300,000 to 500,000. And PTSD doesn't go away. This is something that will last for decades. In many cases, it may just be below the surface. In some cases, it could be 20 years from now, a person has a break. Maybe they take their own life. Maybe they become alcoholic. Maybe they become alcoholic but didn't realize it was PTSD. And PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, this comes from seeing trauma. This comes from seeing something that sticks with you and shocks your consciousness. You might have killed someone. You might have seen someone who you care about killed next to you. You might have, in driving, seen a car that was full of a family that had died, a child, a woman, an old person, and that nightmare sticks with you. One person who I spoke to for the book made the point that if you go through war and you come back and you're not changed, something is very deeply wrong with you. That it's normal that when you're dealing with these kind of stresses, this kind of violence, it's normal that you should change. And if you don't, that's where the issue sets in.
Was there one image in your mind that took you deeper into that feeling of depression and loss?
In 2005, late 2005, I was in an interview in southern Iraq where my translator, who was in Iraq, he spoke fluent Arabic, of course, said to me, "We need to go. There's been a suicide bombing. It's terrible. We need to go cover it," in a nearby city. And when we got there, the hospital where the bodies had been brought was surrounded by people who had lost someone or thought they lost someone, desperately trying to get in and trying to knock down the gates. We sort of snuck in. And inside the fences were rows of bodies covered in white sheets. And what I'll never forget is seeing the families that had made it in walk, pull one sheet back, pull the next sheet back, keep going along these rows till they found the person they were looking for, their son, their daughter, and just breaking down. And that was nearly a decade ago, but that image is one that I have never forgotten, and I don't think I ever will forget.
Tell us about Mark's sons, both Kevin and the other son.
Jeff, this was a family that was in some ways a Norman Rockwell-style family. Mark and Carol, his wife, were deeply in love. They had been in college.
Fortunately, that wasn't the main part of the clip that I thought I recorded, which had a lot more details on how many men have committed suicide serving the corporations of this country and the politicians. I'm telling you, in every war, look at Civil War, half of the men in the psychiatric wards after the Civil War were Civil War veterans. So this goes all the way back to every war. Now, this is not normal for an individual to want to go out and kill somebody. Now, I know everybody gets that feeling once in a while. I'd sure like to kill that person, but mostly it's bullshit. You know it, and I know it. Most people do not think about really physically wanting to kill somebody. Now, when you're in a situation where you're killing people all the time and forced to do it, that's abnormal. See, they're not normal, they're abnormal. A person that goes into a person that's in combat and loves combat and loves to kill, that's the abnormal one. He probably wouldn't get PTSD. But a normal person who does not feel comfortable blowing people away, especially non-combatants, and he comes back and he doesn't bother him at all, there's a person who's got a problem. Well, this thing about being scared to death about so-called terrorism, number one, terrorism is a phony word. It's accepted by a lot of people. I don't accept it. Shortly prior to the start of the London Olympics, there was an outburst of hysteria over the failure to provide sufficient security against terrorism, which I call unconventional warfare. But as Harvard professor Stephen Walt noted yesterday in Foreign Policy, this was all driven as usual by severe exaggerations of the threat. Quote, well, surprise, surprise, not only was there no terrorist attack, the games themselves came off rather well, unquote. Walt then urges this lesson to be learned. Continue to overreact to the terrorist threat. Here I recommend you read John Mueller and Mark G. Stewart's The Terrorism Delusion, America's Overwrought Response to September 11th in the latest issue of International Security. Well, I'd also say as to who they thought it was that did it, too. Mueller and Stewart analyzed 50 cases of supposed Islamic terrorist plots against the United States, and show how virtually all of the perpetrators were, in their words, quote, incompetent, ineffective, unintelligent, idiotic, ignorant, unorganized. Sorry. Whoa, I couldn't hold that one back. Quote former Glenn Carl, former deputy national intelligence officer for transnational threats, saying, we must see jihadists for the small, lethal, disjointed, miserable opponents that they are. Noting further that Al-Qaeda's capabilities are far inferior to its desires. In the next paragraph, Walt essentially makes clear why this lesson will not be learned. Namely, because there are too many American interests, vested interests, in the preparation of this irrational fear. Yeah. Right. Mueller and Stewart estimate that expenditures on domestic homeland security, not counting the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, have increased by more than $1 trillion since 9/11. Even though the annual risk of dying in a domestic terrorist attack, just a minute here, is about 1 in 3.5 million. Using conservative assumptions and conventional risk assessment and methodology, they estimate that for these expenditures to be cost-effective, they would have to have had to deter, prevent, foil, or protect against 333 very large attacks that would otherwise have been successful every year. Finally, they worry that this exaggerated sense of danger has now been internalized. Even when politicians and terrorism experts aren't hyping the danger, the public still sees the threat as large and imminent. As they conclude, Americans seem to have internalized their anxiety about terrorism, and politicians and policymakers have come to believe that they can defy it only at their own peril. Concern about appearing to be soft on terrorism has replaced concern about seeming to be soft on communism, a phenomenon that lasted far longer than the dramatic that generated it. This extraordinarily exaggerated and essential delusional response may prove to be perpetual. which is another way of saying that if you should be prepared to keep standing in these pleasant and efficient TSA lines for the rest of your life, and to keep paying for far-flung foreign inventions designed to root out those nasty jihadists. Many of the benefits from keeping terrorism fear levels high are obvious. Private corporations suck up massive amounts of Homeland Security cash. The state can claim unlimited powers and operate with unlimited secrecy and no accountability. In sum, the private and public entities that shape government policy and drive political discourse profit far too much in numerous ways to allow rational considerations of the terror threat. But there's a very similar and at least equally important constituency deeply vested in the perpetuation of this fear. It's the sham industry, Walt refers to with appropriate scare quotes as terrorism experts, who have built their careers on fear-mongering over Islamic terrorism and can stay relevant only if the threat does. These terrorism experts form an incredibly incestuous, mutual admiration, admiring little clique in and around Washington. Most of them are in Fox TV. They're employed at think tanks, academic institutions, and media outlets. They can and do have mildly different political ideologies. Some are more Republican, some are more Democrat. But as usual for Washington, D.C. cliques, ostensibly, differences in political views are totally inconsequential when placed next to their common group identity and career interests, namely sustaining the myth of the grave threat of Islamic terror in order to justify their fear-based careers. The relevance of their circle and their alleged expertise. Like all adolescent insular cliques, they defend one another reflexively whenever a fellow member is attacked, closing ranks with astonishing speed and loyalty. They take substantive criticisms very personally as attacks on their friends, because a criticism of the genera and any member in good standing of this fiefdom is a threat to their collective interests. On a more substantive level, any argument that puts the menace of Islamic terror into its proper rational perspective, namely that it pales in comparison to the countless other threats, including terrorism from non-Muslim individuals and states, that it is widely exaggerated considering that it is done in its name, and that it is sustained by ugly sentiments of Islamophobic bigotry, is one that must be sharply denounced, such as the relevance, but also their central ideology, that terror is an objective term that just happens almost always to mean Islamic terror, but never American terror. Well, Chicago has more terror in one weekend than the Islamics have committed in this country since 9/11. Ghettos of Chicago and L.A., New York, and all that stuff far overwhelms the threat of Islamic terror. At least, though, like the Islamics do, they do it a lot to themselves. So, just like the blacks in a ghetto do it largely to themselves. Anyhow, I'm not going to go through the whole thing, but it's a regular industry. Just like Homeland Security has spent trillions, billions and trillions, and as I heard one black Homeland Security contractor say that they have made many blacks millionaires in this country. So it's money's is being drained off by all kinds of crooks, So you got to have terrorism. You got to have something you call terrorism. Any little thing they can dream up, any little thing they can encourage somebody to do, works in their favor. Say it's a dangerous game they're playing because the things they do can actually cause, at some point, real terrorism. Then they'll find out something in this country. There hasn't been any real terrorism, any prolonged terrorism. Well, I see that SoundCloud, one of the world's largest online audio distribution platform, has banned an account registered to the National Alliance Reform and Restoration Group. The account hosted recordings from the National Alliance. Late founder Dr. William Pierce interspersed in an interview with his brother Saunders Pierce. Well, you see, this, of course, is pressure put on by the Anti-Defecation League of B'nai B'rith and Morris, the Sleaze D's, and people like that, along with the unsuspecting, just plain people who don't like racial talk. This NARRGS, this Nationalist Alliance account, which was being used as a quasi-recruitment tool aimed at largely at former disillusioned NA members, was removed after SoundCloud determined the account violated the Berlin-based company's terms of use and community guidelines. NAARG was created by former NA members who are attempting to wrest control of what remains of the NA from its current chairman, Eric Levy. We've made the decision to remove this profile and associated tracks from our platform, a SoundCloud representative told Hate Watch. This decision was made pursuant to our terms of use and community guidelines on the grounds of the sentiments expressed in the reported content are contrary to what the Jews and other people like, don't like, and the values of positivity and inclusion that our community was founded on. Oh, sure. That's all bullshit. That's why when these so-called terrorists go after your people, I don't care. I do not care because of the problems you cause with other people with free speech, freedom of assembly, and all the things you do. And if terrorists, offshore terrorists come at your throat, I don't care. I wouldn't raise a finger. SoundCloud has roughly 40 million registered users and 200 million listeners. NARRG, on the other hand, has just a few supporters and is far from the dynamo that the National Alliance was at its height in 2002. So what are you worried about? If there's so few of them, they got no power and they got nothing, what are you so scared about it? You know, racism scares the goddamn shit out of you, and it'll continue to do that even if there's only one in the country. The year William Pierce suddenly died, they talked about. At that time, NA had more than 1,500 dues-paying members and was raking in more than $1 million a year from its various businesses. So you think. So you think. But it's still, that's nothing compared to the power of the corporations and their opponents. So what was the big threat from National Alliance? The most disturbing elements of the recordings that prompted SoundCloud to action were clips from the late William Pierce called for a revolution and for America to be cleansed of Jews. Well, that's opinion. You know, I've got my opinion, you got your opinion, everybody's got opinions. So I don't care what happens to you in Germany either, you know, because you're the people that are cutting off the free speech and assembly and all that and putting people in prison for having a swastika or flag or anything like that. So the hell with you. If the Islamics want to take you down, I'm not good. I wouldn't lift a finger. I wouldn't join the Islamics to do it, but I certainly wouldn't lift a finger to stop them. The most disturbing elements of the recordings that, oh, they already said that, When a mass of slobs instructed and guided by Jewish media bosses are able to determine the outcome of elections, then it's time to stop voting and turn to other means. Well, that's been going on for a long, long time. That didn't just start. Pierce begins in an old recording backed with symphonic music. He did a good job. Pierce did a good job. This was our country, it was our government, and we sat on our hands while the Jews and the Republicans and the Democrats and other rats took it away from us. Then it is our fault, it's our responsibility to take this government down and establish a decent one in its place. Well, it's taking itself down. Don't worry. It's taking itself down. Join me in building a revolution that can cleanse America. Well, it's happening. It's happening. And you don't really have to do much. NA members were connected to 14 separate violent crimes between 84 and 2005. Connected? What do you mean connected? Were they convicted of conspiracy with them? No, they weren't. That ranged from shootouts with police to plans to bomb Disney World. You see how they put the lies in there? I say that's bullshit. I don't know any National Alliance guy, to be perfectly honest, that would have had the balls to do any of that. NAARG is currently in the process of suing Glebe, who took over for Pierce after his death. And that's wonderful how the right wing want to fight each other. NA's two other remaining board members, Ryan Marzica and Jane Cartwright, over the remnants of the National Alliance, the lawsuit was primarily resulted in a series of embarrassing public revelations about the state of the NA and its membership. Well, every organization has a problem like that. I don't know these two people or what they're up to or anything. They've never communicated with me. That's okay. The less the right wing communicates with me, the better. The recordings that were recently removed included repeated pleas for donations to NAARG to cover its legal expenses and their fight against Glebe. As of September 9, 2014, the group claimed it had raised a total of $13,917 from a variety of sources, supposedly enough to cover all legal expenses NAARG has accrued to date. Saunders Pierce, who is listed as a plaintiff in the lawsuit against Glebe and is heavily invested in the revival of his late brother's group, seems to share his brother's violent neo-Nazi views. Well, I didn't even know he had a brother, and I never saw him written up at any time in the past. So what's this Saunders Pierce coming out of the woodwork? We don't want to see violence other than what is necessary in self-defense at this time. It don't do you any good to say that stuff, Saunders Pierce. No matter how peaceful you tell them they're going to be, they're going to say you're a terrorist anyhow. So let them say you're a terrorist. You want to say I'm a terrorist? Okay, I'm a terrorist. I'm a neo-Nazi. I'm a this. I'm a that. I don't even respond to that bullshit. And I would like to emphasize that at this time, it may well be necessary to change that position later. At the end of his conversation with Saunders Pierce, his interviewer remarked that Dr. Pierce better than anyone else recognized the power of propaganda and power of controlled media. I suppose the Jews don't. Unfortunately for NAARG's leadership, they will have to find another platform to make their anti-Semitic calls for cleansing and revolution. All this stuff is a waste of time. None of it's going anywhere. We got quite a ways to go yet before the main fight. And it's not going to take a lot of money to get involved in it. These people think, these Jews obviously think like Jews. And these people that go along with the Jews think like Jews too. They think all it takes is money. Well, money helps, but most revolutions start on a shoestring. And that's the way it is. Anyhow, this was put together by our opponents, obviously. Not so much my opponents, because I don't adhere to the right wing and they don't adhere to me. So They're on their own. On their own, baby. Well, 72% of Americans polled very concerned about the U.S. Ebola outbreak. Frieden's comments come as the first person diagnosed with Ebola in the U.S. died Wednesday, despite intense but delayed treatment. There's also a rumor around it's only going to affect blacks. I've heard that. The U.S. government also announced that it was expanding airport examinations to guard against the spread of the deadly disease. But they're not going to stop the planes because they would lose money. Think of the money that would be lost. So they're going to play Russian roulette. That's the typical greedy capitalist. The checks will include taking the temperatures of hundreds of travelers arriving from West Africa at five major American airports. And it's rumored that they're going to do it the other way. They're going to stick the thermometer up their ass. And that's got a lot of people all excited. The new screenings will begin Saturday at New York's JFK International Airport and then expand to Washington Dulles and the international airports in Atlanta, Chicago, and Newark. An estimated 150 people per day will be checked using a high-tech thermometer that don't touch the skin. 150 a day? Well, there's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people pass through those airports. Maybe 1,000 people a day. Maybe more. Okay. These people are, you know, with the threat of losing money, the corporations and the politicians and everybody say, well, let's make it look like we're doing something, but we sure don't want to interrupt making the money, like sealing him off and stopping him from coming out of Africa at all, like even some of the African countries won't let people fly in from another country. I think it's funny as hell to watch them all on television, everybody going, oh my, oh my, oh my, it's coming. No, it isn't coming. Yes, it is coming. Well, if you do this, it'll work. No, if we don't, that won't work. I love it. Let the sheep bleat. Now, the White House said, you know, I never knew the White House could speak. What do they mean, Obama? The White House said. They said the fever checks would reach more than 9 of 10 travelers in the U.S. Well, considering there's thousands of travelers, if 1 out of 10 is not being checked, That means hundreds and hundreds of people who could be infected are going to run around. You got to do them all, baby. And even then, somebody's going to get through. President Barack Obama calls the measures really just belt and suspenders to support protections already in place. Border Patrol agents now look for people who are obviously ill, as do flight crews. And in those cases, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is notified. What a circle jerk all this stuff is. But also, how are they ever going to get anything done if every time they turn around, somebody's going to say, you're a racist. You did that because you're a racist, man. Yeah, I'm going to complain about that. You lose your job. Okay, I won't do it. I won't take your temperature. I won't stick this thermometer up your ass. Don't call me racist. Anything but that. I'd rather die of Ebola than be called a racist. Well, all this crap is boring. Let's go to, I'm going to read a little bit out of this Equilibrium Manifesto. Oswald Spengler was the first philosopher who had the possibility and who also ventured to exceed the frontiers of Faustian culture and to survey and thus to understand and to interpret universal history from a point of view far above all limits. Friedrich Nietzsche had still developed his philosophy from a view within the borders of the culture he grew up in. And he exhausted his inner possibilities and perspectives thoroughly. Thus, he became one of the greatest philosophers of all times, the last great thinker of what Spengler called the Faustian culture. He became an end, the fulfillment of Faustian thinking. Spengler was the first one to conquer the barriers of Faustian thinking. Principally, even that is purely Faustian, an aspiration into the afar, into the endless and the eternal, an urge that leads as far as conquering itself. Shortly, the Faustian impetus. When Nietzsche was an end, a fulfillment, Spengler was a beginning, the beginning of a quest that is not nearly fulfilled, the beginning of a quest that is only recognized by very few people nowadays. In his most impressive work, The Decline of the West, Spengler tried to connect the history of mankind, which is a history of various different cultures, with the idea of higher destiny. With inner necessity, the fate of every culture is predestined. The eternal cycle of birth, death, rising, and falling. For Spengler, the fact that cultures influence each other, and often even wipe each other out, did not change the basic principle of his thesis. With enormous precision, with immense acuteness and empathy, Spengler has applied this destiny, principle of destiny, to various cultures. And he recognized incontestable parallels in order to deduce forecasts for our civilization. The Occidental, Faustian one, that in its aspiration to infinity encompasses almost the whole terrestrial globe and is already in the stage of dying. Out of inner necessity, every culture thrives after the perfection of its specific perception of the world in politics, art, philosophy, science, and then accomplishes itself. With this accomplishment of culture, the stage of civilization begins. Desperately, the character of the culture is tried to be saved from decline, to force a cultural life upon the civilization. But civilization in itself is in decline, and therefore politics, art, philosophy, and science that are all long ago accomplished die and wither away. Like a plant, every culture needs soil, fertile soil, on which it can prosper. And this fertile soil is healthy folk, a powerful folk. When the stage of civilization has begun, there is no folk anymore. The only folk that exists is a gray mass, one single organism that has lost its energy and creative impulse totally. The foundation of culture is entirely vanished, and just like a plant that withers on dried out poisoned soil, the culture dies as it lacks this fertile soil. One mustn't mislead oneself. Every time when there is a spoken and written about folk of our Western civilization, this is actually a lie, as a healthy folk doesn't exist anymore. This is an illusion that consciously or unconsciously is meant to suppress the emptiness, the decline, and absurdity modern man is forced to live in. Only when civilization has developed, which means in this context declined, so far that primeval state has reoccurred, the state which Spengler called the state without a history. A new, fresh, fragile plant can grow from this state, a new culture with a new powerful folk. Culture and civilization compared to each other are like folk and mass, countryside and town, blood and money. One could call our civilization a natural state of dying, but we mustn't forget that our civilization is the most dangerous, the most destructive one that has ever existed on this planet. According to Spengler, the Occidental culture was always characterized by its aspirations into afar, to the heights, to infinity. The willpower to enter the depth of things, to discover something, is specifically Occidental, and in this characteristic form, unique throughout the entire history of mankind. This will to infinity has blended with science and technology to a unity, and today we have to feel and to suffer from the results of this. Science and technology have existed in all other cultures as well, but they were always derived from nature and were thus subordinate to it. Western man couldn't acquiesce in this. He felt a strong urge to conquer nature and to rule over it, to exploit and to enslave and thus to destroy it. Western man is on its way to destroy every foundation of life on this earth and therefore on the best way to destroy himself. Modern man and nature have become divorced, and this is what makes this Western civilization so dangerous. Where other civilizations have only been a simple dying of what they previously had been strong culture, an end for itself. There is a spirit of total destruction in this Western civilization, the absolute will to the end, to the apocalypse. If nothing is done against the destructive powers of the modern world, the entire earth will perish when the West declines. I hope that I will succeed in outlining the necessities that result from the mentioned facts. Quote, what displays within not even one century is a play of such a dimension that the man of a forthcoming culture with another soul and other passions must be seized by the feelings that nature itself got into staggering back then. Also before the politics have strided upon the cities, the nations, human economy has deeply interfered into the destiny of animal and vegetable kingdom. But this does not only touch life and blots out again, but this technology will leave the mark of its days behind when everything else is long past and sunk. This Faustian landscape has changed the image of the Earth's surface. That's from Oswald Spengler, Decline of the West. The 19th century marked a transition from culture to civilization, a time when the culture was intrinsically accomplished, when Europe groaned in the gruesome grip of industrialization, when man was enslaved by the machine, a time when one could already anticipate the forthcoming emptiness, coldness, and darkness. The Romantic movement reached its peak in this time of longing for the past, when the world was still filled with culture, with spirit, with life. It was a movement that tried to flee from the shadows of the future by unleashing a flood of written word, by creating literature that adored loneliness, solitude, nature, as opposed to the industrialization of the modern world and the decline of the folk into a mass of soulless debris. Enormous thunderstorms began to swell up, thunderstorms that were unleashed in the immense concussions of the 20th century. In this time, 20th century was regarded as a symbol of dread, as a century of modernity, that it only one step away from the abyss of the forthcoming apocalypse. The century of total decline, the Romanticism was a fundamental anti-modern movement. But in its dreamy, visionary attitude that dreamt of a glorious past without caring about any future, it could not stem against the triumphant march of modernity into the already spiritually degenerated European continent. But the Romanticism was far more, though, than a mere and pointless reverie. The entire defense and struggle of the cultural spirit of the West manifested in this movement. And this opposition to the civilizatory powers of progress of money simply had to burst into war. Ernst Junger says that World War I was only superficially a war between different nations. He writes that in the First World War, the 19th century had burned itself at the flames of the 20th century. And the entire meaning of this sentence cannot be regarded as too deep. The progress of the 20th century first of all manifests in the total mobilization, a firework of modern technology, the triumph of the machine. Like human material, the masses are thrown amidst this machinery. Progress is out of control, and man is a mere material that is consumed in this monstrous, gigantic machinery of the modern world. Quote, these modern battles carry the impression of roaring, beating manufacturers in which man is nothing but a number, someone who works at a machine from morning till night, always surrounded by the monotonous rattling without the knowing what this will become and what the use of what he does will be. War of industry, of the modern way of life, battles that are the competitive struggle of two combines, with the factors, better goods, and faster production, and one single stranger, this little human being soldier, thee to the last appreciated material, in spite of schools and barracks. That was from Hans Zöberlein, Mein Glaube, from Deutschland. The mass destruction of war is only possible because war has become something the masses participate in. A healthy folk has a privileged warrior caste. War is a form of war that should only be practiced by a few chosen ones, as only then the magical character of war can be saved from decline. As a part of evolution, war owns vast creative powers. With the appearance of the masses and the decline of aristocratism, war rose its creative powers and is only destructive. Is bereaved of its evolutionary value and principle anti-evolutionary. The symbolic powers of blood are replaced by purely economic interests. And beyond the roaring thunder of the battle, only one single word thrown above all, profit. On this background, the destructive activity of the modern genocidal wars is a product of the Judeo-Christian and democratic and socialist equalization. The principle of nature bears the principle of inequality, and this principle of heterogeneity also reigns in the subconscious of man. The Christian Democrat mass manipulation may have superficially reached its ideal of equality, but in the collective subconscious, such unnatural ideals cannot make their way and establish themselves. In contrary, the more human instincts are suppressed, the more destructive they will erupt one day. Only on this background, the almost unimaginable destructivity of the old both world wars can be understood. With the end of World War I, the ancient aristocratic monarchic order that existed for so long, especially in Germany, is swept away and the people stand amidst the bleak ruins of modernity. They are thrown into this century, this battlefield of modernity, the dragon called civilization. Now they entirely feel and understand the total emptiness and the blackness of this modern world. The intrinsically accomplished Occidental culture seems to be dead. It didn't happen accidentally that the powers of blood began to arise in this time. People remember their roots. Nature speaks through the gates of the collective subconscious and defends itself against the suppression of human instincts. The conflict of blood against money bursts out openly after having set in decades ago. No one can really feel the free current of blood and the spirit of nature in this time when the blood-driven movements and groups of pagans, occultists, esotericists, and so on grew bigger and more influential. Previously, they were only existed far in the background, in the shadow of the Christianized world that tried desperately to extinguish the principles of nature totally. But now, in the early 20th century, they enter the light, fill up the emptiness that was cast upon Europe by the arising of civilization. Ancient symbols of life, symbols of the sun and of the blood of nature, enter the surface of human conscious subconsciousness. The most known and most amused of them all, the swastika, and became symbols of the neo-pagan occult renaissance of the aristocratic principle, symbols of the longing for a home in a time when Europe was about to suffocate in the stench of industry, the cities, and the mass of human debris. From this movement of blood, from the dream of a new heathendom, National Socialism as a political representation of esoteric occult roots was born. What finally grew from this is a different thing. National Socialism is not a topic that shall fill the entire book, which would be pointless anyway, as more space would be needed to analyze this certainly deep and complex topic. But in this context, it is indispensable to indicate from which esoteric depth this movement entered the surface of history. It wasn't at all just for the realization of merely political ideals. It was an attempt to avert this twilight of the gods, this age of Fimbul Winter, the Kaliyuga, to leave this lowest point in history of humanity, to return to the Hyperborean roots and to the principles of evolution and thus life itself. In later years, though, the official National Socialism had nothing in common anymore with the intended pagan occult renaissance of the earlier days. It merely was a disposal of industry and economy. It didn't have anything in common anymore with the principles of blood from which it had actually been born and risen. Furthermore, it was a fatal error to believe the inner progress of a culture would be reversible. The psychogomic tact that Spengler had so ingeniously analyzed of a culture is determined by the influences beyond the actions of a single movement. It lies in the collective subconscious. The past got under the wheels of the present, and the plutocratic forces were still too powerful. To start a serious revolt against the forces of plutocracy, one had to be militarily equal. But with rearmament and increasing industrialization, one was automatically under the curse of economic dependence, a fatal contradiction, which was the path that led to World War II. Surely one had to distinguish exoteric and esoteric National Socialism, something that especially Miguel Serrano has pointed out. Both were designed to stand in harmony to each other, but both were nevertheless quite separated from each other. Some important personalities of the esoteric SS have never been part of any political party or organization, nor did they really support the esoteric, secular, political, profane ideologies. Otto Rahm is probably the best example of this. The esoteric circles were designed to found an influential spirit elite that should act in the underground. And it is significant that the existence of some of these circles was even unknown to most members of the political esoteric movements. A strong contradiction was the result of this, a contrast between the elite consciousness of today, mostly unknown and forgotten esotericists and mysticists, and more ignorant gray materialism, the industrialization of the official state that could only function under the consideration of the masses that make the 20th century an absurd, demonic theater. Every mass movement stands in opposition to culture, to spirit, to evolution, to development. The masses represent involution, degeneration, and decline, and were thus like deadly poison for the esoteric ideals of those forces that gathered under the esoteric symbol of the swastika. This ancient symbol of the conquering of the Kali Yuga Only under the influence of the masses it could result in such a violent firestorm. The final decline of the esoteric foundation of National Socialism caused the fatal secularization, the development into a monstrum of a state that didn't have anything in common anymore with the spiritual, Volkish values. In the end, it was nothing but just another representor of the dark age of decline, whatever you like to call it. This current of blood led into the catastrophe and finally died in the stench of the modern world, in the emptiness of the Western Americanized civilization. But it has certainly not been the last ascension of the blood. Due to the explosive energies of World War II, the decline of the Occidental civilization was swiftly accelerated. When Spengler called the state within history is a terrible reality since 1945, in the morass of democracy, modern freedom, which actually is the peak of slavery, and the political correctness, the last remnants of a once so strong culture wither away. Only the demonic emptiness of modernity is left. Every pagan, aristocratic, or even simply intelligent ideology is cursed as fascistic or is not understood anymore. America scatters its spiritual poison into the world under the banner of economy. Nature is destroyed. And the throning above all, the mass manipulation, the constant irrigation by the media, the shameless stupefaction and equalization, which is fascism in its purest form, the envy and hate of low beings against those who still stand for spiritual, healthy, and high values. Only spiritually degenerated and mediocre subhumans are useful in the labor camp, or should I better say, concentration camp, of the modern world. Only degenerated humans endure the dullness and hopelessness that can participate in this theater of decline that is applauded by the masses who are not able to watch beyond the surface of things, a frightening play. For all those who have not lost their soul and spirit in the emptiness of these times, the coldness and darkness that lies like a deep fog upon Europe is no secret anymore. Is it too late? Perhaps it is not too late. A new ascension of the blood, in connection with the Faustian aspiration into infinity, seems to begin with these days, but it is a race with time, because, as I have already mentioned, for the first time the world is in danger of declining with the downfall of a culture. Nietzsche and Spengler have created the foundation of a Faustian philosophy of infinity, for which the right time has come now. Until today, all cultures have vanished, disappeared, because they lacked the understanding of their own inner development. And Sakyadamits, they were born and they died, but incomparably with a little child, they had no consciousness of their own life and death, of their destiny. Since Spengler, it is possible for a whole culture to develop this consciousness and to use it for a Faustian quest. Spengler had described the Faustian aspiration into infinity in the most ingenious, magnificent, and underwhelming way. And now it is our task to conquer the forces of decline, to reanimate the Faustian soul, and to make European culture a culture for eternity, to overcome these frontiers that Spengler still felt subordinate to. We have to build a new pagan renaissance that is based on ancient traditions, but that is dedicated to the future in order to fulfill the destiny of Faustian man, the overman, and to reach the Faustian aim, the stars. This quest is only recognized as such only by a very few people, but a matter of a few is always better than a matter of the many, of the masses, as the masses and the most fatal sickness and elite that is dedicated to blood and nature can be infected with. The masses do not have blood. the creativity, the creative piety, or to put it more in depth, the ancient tract attacked from better, earlier times afar that further acts shaping in the will, adheres only to the shapes for us they are older than Napoleon and the Revolution, that are grown and not planned. Every, no matter how modest the rest of this, which is preserved in the key of any unanimous minority, will soon enough rise to unmeasurable value and create historical effects that in this moment no one regards as possible. Yet, the traditions of an ancient monarchy, an ancient aristocracy, an ancient nobility, noble society, as long as they are still healthy enough to keep aloof from the politics as a business or for the sake of an abstraction, as long as they bear honor, renunciation, discipline, and true feeling of a great mission, hence characters of race, property, and the sense of obligations and sacrifices, can become a center that maintains the stream of being of a whole folk, lets it last outlast these times and reaching the shores of the future. Paragraph was from Oswald Spengler, Decline of the West. Let us enter our ships, let us put to sea today, because otherwise we will never reach the shore of the future. But what exactly is this shore of the future that Spengler has written about? How can it be reached, and who will reach it? The shore of the future is what I want to call the new aeon, a new era of European culture that will arise after decline of the West, a new era that will be fulfillment of the Faustian destiny, the age of the overman, in a world that will see the restoration of the natural equilibrium. We must now create the foundation for what following generations will have to continue to accomplish. It will be a quest of very few to bridge over this time of emptiness and decline and to carry the spirit of European culture into the new aeon. This is for me the innermost essence of the word elite. People who are not infected by the moral viruses of the modern world. People who have conquered the Christian dualism and who carry the natural equilibrium deep in their souls and their minds, knowing very little that good and evil, light and darkness, love and hate are all a part of the greater, higher unity. People who are filled with the top, from the top to the toe, with the spirit of nature, and who are feeling love, respect, and responsibility towards their Mother Earth. People who are willing to make sacrifice for their ideals, and who are able to recognize what their own personal higher will is. People who are conscious of the fact that they contribute to something higher and greater that has existed beyond all strict, stubborn, and empty political ideologies and dogmas, beyond left and right, and who do not let others dissuade and manipulate the further way into promising future. Even if this means to be exposed to the envy, hate, and ignorance of the manipulated, cowardly herd that believes in having found a new dangerous foe in something they do not even in the least understand the necessity of. Masses of degenerated sheep that stigmatize everything their spirit is too small and low for the word fascism. A dull horde of spiritually and intellectually underdeveloped fools who arrogantly presume ideals of utopic and dangerous without having the necessary spirit, intuition, consciousness of nature, and as demonic as it seems to be, without having what could be called a soul. To make this perfectly clear, the spiritual elite I'm talking about represents the transcendence and thus cannot be materialistic and secular, and is therefore not, to the last least, political, as all politics are just eminent and low nature and are not taken into consideration at all because of this. I want to point it out with absolute clearness, a truly spiritual elite will not support any political ideology, as politics have no place in a natural philosophy of transcendental alignment. And that's all I'm going to read for today. We'll I think we'll finish that up tomorrow. I think it's very important that we understand this. That's why I take the position that there's very little we can do to salvage this modern Western society. I don't think we want to. I think it has to fall. I think it has to crash. It has to disintegrate. And like he says, a new aeon begin. So I hope you got that message. This is Terrible Tommy. I'm off and clear for today, Thursday, the 9th of October, 2014. And I'll be back tomorrow on Freya's Day. And in the meantime, Lone Wolf, he who travels fastest travels alone.